This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Just this morning, one of the undecided races from last night's primary voting is now decided. First Congressional District incumbent Frank Ginta will be the Republican nominee, with his challenger, Rich Ashew, conceding after a very tight race. So at this point, one primary on the Republican side remains too close to call, the GOP nomination for governor. Now that's in comparison to three other major primaries with decisive victories last night in the Republican contests for U.S. Senate and the second Congressional District, also in the Democratic race for governor. Today in The Exchange, post-primary results and that one outstanding question. Let's hear from you. What's your take on who won, who lost, and why? And how do you think last night's voting sets the table for November? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests in studio. Dan Barracks here, NHPR Senior Policy and Politics Editor. And Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Kevin Landrigan, Senior Reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Kevin, good to see you. Thanks for being here as well.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, and Kevin, you've been covering New Hampshire politics for a long time. What do you make of how close it was last night?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Certainly, we're seeing that the turnout was a little less than Secretary of State Bill Gardner said it would be, which may have led to the tightening in this race. Certainly, in the race for governor with four candidates, there was an expectation in that race that it probably would be close. But to have so many very close primaries. I can't remember an election quite like this one. I mean, all the way down the ballot, you've
right.
got, even at this hour, you have like state senate races with less than 25 votes separating the candidates. In all likelihood, down ballot, I think we're going to see some recounts and maybe a large number. Bill Gardner says we usually get as many as 20. When you count all the legislative races, and maybe it'll be even more than that.
Well, and we all thought, Dan, when we were planning for last night, that, you know, we'd be done by maybe 9:30, maybe 10 o'clock. That didn't turn out to happen. When we left at 11 or 11:30, it was still undecided. What do you think?
You know, if you need any reminder of why we actually hold elections and not just
right.
talk about them for months and months, it was last night. As Kevin said, the number of narrow nail biters and at this hour still open races is pretty phenomenal. I mean, with the Rich Ashew Frank Ginta race that was only recent within the last 10 minutes, Rich Ashew conceded to Frank Ginta, I think 600 votes separating them out of 56,000 cast.
Wow, not a lot.
A number of state senate races with I think one with a dozen differences. And I think the real surprise, perhaps Frank Ginta surviving a strong primary challenge from a well-funded, respected candidate, is certainly one big headline. The other has got to be the Republican nomination for governor, which is still open at this point, with Chris Sununu holding on to a narrow, I think, about 1,000 vote lead at this hour over Frank Edelblut. You think about how that race had been framed over the last few weeks and months even. It was not – you know, Frank Edelblut was largely not in the conversation. It was about how is Ted Gatzis, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis, and Chris Sununu jockeying at the top? Where's the momentum going? Who's winning the debates? Who's winning – you know, whose defectors are moving from one camp to the other? And you see, you know, an outsider, very conservative candidate like Frank Edelblut, who had been talking – if you talk to him and his supporters for months, they said – we're building a grassroots operation. We have the support and endorsement of some of these very conservative activist groups. And lo and behold, he pulled off the shocker of the night. Whether he wins or loses, he definitely had a huge night.
Well, it's a great point that you make, Dan. And Kevin, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, too, that, you know, this is why we hold elections. We don't just, you know, talk about them because sometimes we're wrong.
Yeah, no, it's true. Certainly during the over the weekend, after all the debates that were on WMUR, the Union Leader was a co-sponsor of those debates. There was certainly a recognition that Frank Edelblut did pretty well in that debate. But we had a discussion on close-up over the weekend, and I basically said that at that point, what I'd been hearing in the polling internally by independent groups that were polling in this race for governor on the Republican side was that Edelblue was on the move. He was the one candidate over the last 10 days who really started to move. And I think it was largely a combination of some of what Dan was talking about, ran a very good grassroots organization, had very good mail. I thought some of the best mail in the race. And when you have a low turnout, that matters because these are activists. These are people who regularly vote, and they tend to pay attention to mail even more than the back and forth of ads. I also think the attacks between Gatsis and Sununu really helped create a lane for Frank Edelblue, who ran a very positive race. I think that's the other thing Republicans feel very good about here is that whoever wins this race, it's in all likelihood going to be Chris Sununu, frankly, but whoever wins it, there's going to be a lot of unity there. Edelblue and Sununu really get along well. They had very good things to say about one another throughout this campaign.
Well, and speaking of unity, the Republican Unity Breakfast is going on right now. NHPR's Josh Rogers is there. He says Kelly Ayotte is speaking at this point, and Josh will join us as soon as he can duck out of the room. While we're talking about this still undecided Republican nomination for governor, let's hear a little bit from Chris Sununu last night. You know, results were still unknown. The natives were getting restless, so to speak. And here's Executive Counsel Chris Sununu just coming down to encourage his supporters.
Look, there's still a good amount of votes to be counted out there, to be sure. So it's exciting. We feel great. We're upbeat. My wife calls me the eternal optimist, as I say in the video. We feel really, really, really good. But I did want to come over and just thank everyone.
Again, that's Executive Counselor Chris Sununu thanking supporters, telling them to hang on. Today in The Exchange, we are looking at last night's primary results, including the still undecided Republican gubernatorial nomination. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dan and Kevin, let's go to our listeners. Jason's calling from Manchester. Hi, Jason. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Hi. I wondered as I checked the results this morning if the overall number of Republican and Democratic ballots have anything predictive to say about the general election.
The overall number of ballots and how this sets the table then, Jason, for the election. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think certainly we've seen in some presidential years before that the September primary turnout sags a little bit when we've had very aggressive, very expensive presidential races before. This turnout, I think, is probably going to prove to be pretty pedestrian, pretty much on a par with what we've seen in the last four or five presidential primaries seasons. I think the turnout in the presidential election will really be driven by, in all likelihood, at the top of the ballot, the kind of race that Clinton and Trump run. There's certainly a lot of political scientists nationally who believe this is going to be such a nasty race that it could actually drive down turnout nationally. We hope that doesn't happen here in New Hampshire, but it could.
Dan, I'd love your thoughts, too, on the impact of the presidential race, especially given the high unfavorables that both nominees have, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. What's the impact of that possibly going to be on New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, the actual turnout of, say, yesterday's vote, I haven't seen the numbers yet. What I've read and heard anecdotally is that it seemed like more independents were taking Republican ballots than Democratic. And I think that was the case also in the presidential primary. So, you know, what that tells you, I mean, on one hand, there were a lot more contested Republican primaries yesterday, both congressional seats.
Sure.
Kelly Ayotte's Senate seat, a lot more state Senate and executive council seats. But I think Kevin's right. I mean, in a presidential year, we know in New Hampshire, that's a different animal in terms of type of election. You see a lot more people coming out. You see a lot more infrequent voters, including college students. We have, you know, that's a big factor. And it's what's driven in this weird sort of swing back and forth over the last 15 years we've seen now where Democrats do much better in presidential years. But this is a presidential year like no other in terms of not only just the prologue to it, the kinds of candidates who've succeeded in the primaries state to state, but also just the tone and the favorability. And I don't know. I mean, I think we still have, you know, a week feels like an eternity in this political year. And we still have, believe it or not, 2 months left before we elect a president on down.
So. Well, so again, it's often been said that Democrats tend to do well in presidential years. But this year, who knows?
Right.
because who knows is probably a good way to approach the coming election. Since we're talking about the effect of the top of the ticket on New Hampshire races, I want to play for you guys a little bit of audio from WMUR. This is U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte, who easily won her primary and afterwards was asked about the effect of Donald Trump on her reelection.
I think it's really going to be about is who can deliver results for the people of New Hampshire and who can be that strong voice for New Hampshire, no matter who's in the Oval Office. And in the Senate, I've been focusing on getting work done, for example, to pass the bipartisan heroin legislation, get better care for our veterans, and also fighting to make sure, I mean, you need a fighter in Washington, but someone who can work across the aisle like I have.
Again, that's U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte, won her primary against Jim Rubins last night and is now going to face Maggie Hassan in her reelection bid. And Dan, what do you think about what we heard from Kelly Ayotte just saying, you know, it doesn't really matter who's the top of the ticket. I'm fighting for New Hampshire.
And she's been saying that for months. And she's kind of had to because of the Trump effect, but also because she's facing a very, you know, in Governor Hassan, a very relatively well-liked candidate, well-funded, experienced candidate who's going to attract a lot of outside attention. She has to really she's been talking about this bipartisan approach that she claims throughout. And it was very – I mean, it was notable throughout her, you know, we haven't mentioned it yet, but she also had a primary last night, which she won pretty handily, about 80%. But she ran that primary as though it were a general election, not, you know, just sort of building this case for months that she was not going to be tied to Donald Trump. She was not going to let that happen, that she was going to run in this sort of tradition that we have in New Hampshire where candidates, you know, elected officials who go down to Washington portray themselves in this true bipartisan, quote unquote, New Hampshire spirit of deal making.
How have you heard Kelly Ayotte talking about this, Kevin Landrigan?
Yeah, I think she certainly feels like certainly very grateful to get a really good primary outcome last night, about 80% of the vote, which is really impressive in the Republican primary. I think one of the things she did well in this race, she kept her focus during the debates and throughout the campaign on Governor Hassan, who is popular, as Dan pointed out. But I don't think took primary voters for granted. She was she certainly didn't ignore Jim Rubins or try and run away from him, debated him enough times that activists felt like there was a real election here. But Rubins was really never in the conversation, completely and badly outspent and outgunned in this race. And certainly now we have the outcome everyone is looking for. And we certainly heard from Governor Maggie Hassan a very strong, a very on the offensive message last night at her victory party, too.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us with your questions, comments, thoughts about last night's primary voting, how it sets up the general election in November, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dan Barrick's here. He's NHPR's senior policy and politics editor, along with Kevin Landrigan, senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And guys, as we look at the one outstanding race from last night, that's the Republican nomination for governor. Here's an update for you. Chris Sununu now at 30.7% and Frank Edelblew at 29.7%. So 1 percentage point between them. There's a unity breakfast going on right now for Republicans, and we're wondering how they're going to handle this outstanding situation. NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers is there in Bedford. Hi, Josh. Thank you for being with us.
Good to be here.
So what's the latest that you know, Josh, on this outstanding Republican nomination for governor?
A bit of suspense. Both sides are somewhat confident that their voters are coming in. The mood in the room here at the breakfast seems to be that, you know, Sununu is going to prevail, until the election is certified. We don't know. There's certainly no indication from Frank Edelblew as he was working the room that he was planning to concede. So I guess we'll just see how this plays out during the course of the day.
So they're both there, Josh.
They're both there. Very jovial. Frank Edelblew is getting a lot of attention. A lot of people were mentioning to me that they were surprised by how well he done. I mean, a lot of people thought that he was coming on towards the end of the campaign, but, you know, he's still a pretty new entity in New Hampshire politics. You know, one-term state rep, not well-known even to a lot of Republican insiders, but, you know, he's sitting at a front table here as Chris Christie speaking, and, you know, lots of claps on the back, and, this is a kind of pep rally event, but there certainly don't seem to be any ill feelings between Sununu and Edelblew. They were chatting. you know, taking pictures together. You know, this is a kind of up with the party kind of event.
And Kevin Landrigan's here. Josh, I think he wants to ask you something.
Yeah, Josh, having been involved with a lot of these close elections before, as we've seen, do you think Sununu has to figure out a way to deploy Edelblue in the fall election? I mean, particularly among those Tea Party libertarian-minded Republicans who, frankly, were turned off to Sununu's message from the beginning.
Well, I certainly don't think that would be a bad idea if they could come to terms on some way to do that. It is interesting to look at the way, you know, Edelblue is getting a lot of face time with legislative leaders, you know, possibly more face time than he gets at the State House. you know, former Governor Craig Benson is here at the head table. He was huddled with Frank Edelblue. Edelblue is kind of the belle of the ball here this morning. You know, a lot of people were surprised by his performance and, you know, feel that he's acquitted himself well. So I guess we'll see where this goes. But I think your point is well taken in terms of, you know, you look at how the vote split up. Obviously, a lot of the core conservatives went with Edelblue. And, you know, Sununu is going to need all those folks to be enthusiastic about him, you know, come November if he, in fact, is the nominee.
Right, if, in fact, he is. And what about Ted Gatzis, Josh? Is he there? He was sort of one of the men to beat.
Well, they're all here. I mean, you know, Gatzis knew pretty early on last night that it wasn't going to be his night. You know, he doesn't look excited about that. But, you know, unlike state office holders, he's still the mayor.
He still has a job.
And so, you know, he said last night to supporters that, you know, he's going to continue to defend Manchester City, in which he says he's immensely proud of. And so, you know, that's his presentation here. But, you know, it's not like people are flocking to him. And I think people here are also coming to terms with the concession of Rich Ashew to Frank Ginta. I mean, you know, Frank Ginta obviously won enough votes to win. But, you know, in this room where there are a lot of top party officials, a lot of these folks wanted him gone. And so while, you know, there's a sense of relief that this thing is settled, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And, you know, certainly shared antipathy towards Carol Shea Porter may heal some of the bad feeling, but that's going to be interesting to watch as well.
Wanted him gone, Josh, because of his campaign finance scandal a couple years ago. Someone said last night on our broadcast that Kelly Ayotte was really hoping to shake Rich Ashew's hand at the Unity Breakfast, not Frank Ginta's. What's your take on that, Josh?
Well, obviously, I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to imagine that the Democrats are going to add the name Ginta to the Trump Ayotte Ginta ticket kind of epithet that they will, you know, try to hang around her neck, and you know, maybe that will work, maybe it was. I mean, Kellyanne did, she was the first at the podium this morning, and she, you know, she's speaking to a partisan crowd, but she was, you know, saying that she was going to point out, you know, some of Maggie Hassan's, you know, what Republicans would consider embellishments of her record around the State House in terms of, you know, fiscal matters on the budget, and was also going to try to draw a real contrast on national security issues. There was a lot of talk, you know, it was a brief speech, but a real stress on Iran, which is, you know, obviously kind of a red meat issue for Republicans. But you can already see that Kellyanne's looking to use her position on the Foreign Services Foreign Relations Committee as an edge over Maggie Hassan. And, you know, she's been complaining that Maggie Hassan doesn't want to do a national security debate. So I'm sure we're going to see that ratchet up as this moves on. But, you know, there's going to be a flood of money in this race, as already has been. And we'll see how both of them deal with the increased scrutiny as the general election begins in earnest.
All right, Josh, we'll let you get back to covering that Unity Breakfast. Thank you very much.
Later.
That's NHPR's Josh Rogers, our senior political reporter. Coming up, we'll look at some of the other races, including some down-ballot races, how they may be affected by last night's primary voting. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the results of yesterday's New Hampshire primary, the surprises, the victories, and what to expect in November. We'd love to hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love your reactions and thoughts about last night's voting, and again, how it sets the table for the November elections. Dan Barrick is here. He's NHPR's senior policy and politics editor, along with Kevin Landergan, senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And guys, here's an email from Christopher in Manchester who says, I think Ashu was hurt by the fact that for someone with low name recognition or challenging an incumbent, it's basically a 2-week campaign after August's end. Folks snooze over the summer. Christopher, thank you so much. What do you think about that, Kevin? It's worth noting that New Hampshire and just a handful of states held their primaries yesterday. A lot of states did it, you know, earlier.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that certainly may have hurt trying to get recognition. I was just struck by, you know, the tonnage of TV advertising that the Clinton campaign did in New Hampshire over the last many months. You had Ayotte and Hassan, all the super PACs. And these other races down ballot, even the race for governor, really didn't start with a major media campaign until less than a month before the primary. That's really unusual that it started that late. And I thought a number of these campaigns weren't as well financed as I think they hoped they would be. Rich Ashu's, I would count that as one. He did reasonably well in campaign finance, but not as well as they wanted to do. And as a result, they really didn't have a paid media campaign on the air trying to build his name recognition during the summer. I think it did play a factor in this race.
What do you think, Dan? Chris's point that folks snooze over the summer, to put it in his words.
I think there's some truth to that, and we've been dealing with this long post-presidential primary hangover. But on the other hand, this race was really about Frank Gintt and no one else. And Ashu was happy to make it sort of focus on that, on his FEC, his fundraising violations, and this notion. You heard even Ashu last night speaking to his supporters. It was about character and trust. I think the general election is going to be very much the same. That Carol Shea Porter, these two know each other very well, but this will really be, in some ways, it's always that case when you've got an incumbent running that the election is about can be made a referendum on them. But given the events of the last year and Frank Gintt's challenges and his essential, as Kevin alluded to earlier, his abandonment by much of the state Republican establishment, this race is really a referendum on whether or not you believe that Frank Gintt deserves to remain in office given all that.
Well, and some people, Kevin, last night were surprised that he was able to hang on, given that he was dogged by this campaign finance scandal. Let's hear Frank Gintt. He was asked about it, of course, last night, and he maintained that, look, voters are ready to move on.
Look, we focused on public policy, and I think the strong showing tonight recognizes that people want to see an independent-minded conservative leader in representing them in Washington, D.C., and that's what I'll continue to do.
So there he is. He's a survivor, Kevin.
He sure is. I mean, Frank Gintt, throughout his political career, has always exceeded expectations. I mean, I can remember in the mid-90s when he first ran for mayor as an alderman from Manchester, kind of tall but kind of dumpy guy, not a really articulate speaker, running against Bob Baines, who was a popular Democratic mayor, lost in the preliminary election to Baines, and everybody thought, well, that'll be that. And 5 or 6 weeks later, won convincingly against Baines, won re-election, then won the congressional seat as a Tea Party favorite in 2010. Somebody who obviously has beaten Carol Shea Porter twice before, so I wouldn't count him out in this November election. I do think this race will very much track the race for governor. I think if a Republican is elected governor of New Hampshire, it's conceivable Gintt hangs on and wins re-election. If not, I mean, if Colin Van Osterden is governor, I find it hard to see him surviving.
Well, and this morning when Frank Ashu conceded just before the unity breakfast, I don't have the exact language in front of me, but it was pretty tepid, Kevin, you know, sort of, I'll support the ticket and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, during the televised debate last week, Rich Ashu refused to say he would endorse Gintt, and there certainly wasn't any endorsement of Gintt in this statement. He wanted to position the party for victory in November. One thing we really should mention here, certainly there are going to be some supporters of Ashu and Frank Edelblum, frankly, who look at these returns this morning and say, why not have a recount?
What are the rules around recounts in New Hampshire?
If recounts are less than 1%, then the candidate doesn't have to pay for it. Up to 2%, the candidate can ask for a recount, but between 1 and 2 has to pay in varying amounts the cost of that recount. A couple of things to keep in mind. I don't want to go too far into the weeds here, but recounts, winning in recounts, and I've attended a lot of them, is really all about human error. And hundreds and hundreds of votes is just too many human errors that do occur. The voting machines rarely make a mistake. It's really more than 80% of precincts in New Hampshire use voting machines. The rest are in hand counts. So that's really the mother's milk of recounts. You really want those hand-counted towns.
I see, the smaller towns.
Yeah. And the only other human errors that do occur with voting machines is basically on these summary sheets that at the end of the night, the poll worker writes down the totals from the machines. And occasionally you'll see a poll worker actually make a mistake, write the wrong number or transpose numbers that happen, and you'll see a large result that will occur. But in this, to this degree, meaning hundreds and hundreds of votes, it's just not in the cards for a recount to change to that degree.
Interesting. Go ahead, Dan. Yeah.
You mentioned the kind of tepid endorsement or support by Rajesh of Frankent. I mean, as recently as yesterday, Kelly Ayotte reiterated her position that Frankent should resign.
As recently as yesterday.
She was asked about it. She said, my position hasn't changed since last spring, in which she said, if I were him, I'd resign. Over these. So she's in the unusual position of being kind of sandwiched at the top of the ticket between Donald Trump, a presidential candidate who we have seen her try to maintain an arm's distance from all year, and Frankent below her, the congressional candidate who she has said should resign from office.
Okay. Well, if Josh were still with us, we could ask if Frankent and Kelly Ayotte were sitting at the same table at that Unity breakfast. Probably not. Let's take another call. This is Robert in Amherst. Go ahead, Robert. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I wondered what Kelly Ayotte's position is on Medicare and Social Security. You can't tell from the different ads that are on television.
It's a great question. And, gentlemen, I don't know if you have any light to shed on this. Kevin, do you know? I mean, he's right. All candidates say, I love Medicare, I love Social Security, but the details are sometimes hard to come by.
Yeah, certainly Senator Ayotte has supported with regard to Medicare, changes in Medicare to, and in Social Security, has been open to making changes in Social Security in order to make both programs more solvent in the past. She's come under criticism from Governor Hassan for supporting Medicare changes that that supported kind of a private sector option for a lot of people on Medicare that – certainly Democrats have been very critical about.
Well, and guys, let's talk about some of the other races that were not so tight last night, including the Democratic gubernatorial nomination race, decided Dan Barrick pretty early and pretty easily.
Pretty early. And this was not a huge surprise. Colin Van Ostrom, the nominee, winning the three-way race, Mark Connelly and Steve Marchin. I think what was a surprise was the margin. He won slightly more than half of the vote. And you know, folks who've been watching this who knew sort of state Democratic politics, the momentum seemed to be moving in Van Ostrom's way for a while. He had the experience, you know, having worked as a campaign operative for a while, worked on and run a couple of campaigns. He directed up a lot of the endorsements, major endorsements, labor unions, Planned Parenthood's Action Committee, and the money and support that comes with that. I mean, I think he was the beneficiary of almost $250,000 in outside spending from some of these groups, mailers and stuff. And that matters, in as Kevin pointed out, in a low turnout primary. And he won, you know, the geographic diversity. He won up and down the state. He won cities. He won towns. So I think he's in a good position. We heard last night him describing himself very much in the mold of the successful Democratic gubernatorial candidate of John Lynch and Meg Hassan and Gene Shaheen. Liberal on social issues, anti-tax, sort of business-friendly. He's positioning himself as an example of sort of the new New Hampshire economy, talking up his experience with well-known employers like Southern New Hampshire University and Stonyfield. And I think what will be interesting, whether the nominee on the Republican side is Sununu or Edelblu, both of those men are also jockeying for that position. I mean, we talk about Edelblu as the conservative, you know, the candidate of the conservative activist base, but his introduction to this race, his first web ad, was him hailing an Uber on his mobile phone. He has a background in entrepreneurism, and part of his campaign, he's talked about trying to attract venture capital funding. These are not the typical positions of somebody who is the quote unquote far right candidate in a gubernatorial race. Sununu as well talks a lot about his experience owning and managing Waterville Valley Resort. Talks about small business and entrepreneurship. So this is going to be. This is going to be the turf on which this gubernatorial race, I think, is largely fought.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Colin Van Ostern kind of positioning himself in that Shaheen, Lynch, Hassan more moderate mode. Let's hear Colin Van Ostern last night presenting his hopes and, as you said, Dan, emphasizing his willingness to work with Republicans.
The decisions we make in the next 2 years will determine our state's economic future for the next decade to come. I know we can move our state forward the New Hampshire way. We will leave politics at the door. And we'll bring people together to work together with a focus on progress, not on partisanship.
What do you think about that, Kevin Landrigan?
Well, like Dan said, and much like Gene Shaheen, this guy started out as a political operative. He campaigns very much like a political operative, not very calculating, very cautious, but – very sure of himself, and this was a very impressive win. He certainly had the financial advantage over both Mark Connelly and Steve Marshine, but to get almost 55% of a vote in a three-way primary is really impressive. And he did it the way a political operative would do it. Political operatives understand that campaign finance is really about building a network, and that's what he did. He used his ability to raise money, more money than any other candidate, by the way, in this race, to gather supporters for his candidacy. He ended up with almost 2,500 contributors, which is a lot in a small state like New Hampshire. How big is it? 2,500 supporters, more than all the other candidates combined in this race.
Wow. And he's, some people feel like he's had his eye on the governor's race for a while, Kevin, right? I mean,
right.
Even I remember three, four years ago, people would say, oh, there goes Governor Van Ostern. He's been involved in politics for a long time, even though in this race he presented himself as the businessman.
Right. He is and sort of understood this this kind of ministerial job of executive council can be actually good training to be governor. You're there every 2 weeks. You see all the contracts. You get very familiar with these department heads that you would have to manage if you were the governor. Certainly Judd Gregg understood someone many moons ago that the executive council can be a stepping stone to this job.
And he was also the beneficiary of, I guess you would say, good timing on that,
right,
too. A number of as Kevin said, the executive council is typically kind of an administrative job. You approve contracts, you approve appointments, you're the board of directors for the state. But a number of sort of politically charged issues have come before the council, right. Funding for Planned Parenthood, Medicaid expansion contract. I think Van Ostern
commuter rail was another
commuter,
one, right?
Exactly.
Another big controversy.
What was very strategic in how he talked about those votes, how he campaigned on them, and they happen to be issues that are kind of at the core of Democratic politics here in the state. Chris Sununu, the other executive counselor in this race, in many ways found himself on the other end of those. He's pro-choice, but had a hard time kind of explaining why he voted against Planned Parenthood contracts. So it was interesting way in which this kind of backwater of state government, although in reality it's not, had the politics of that body, of that five-member board, has really influenced this race so much.
You know what else is interesting? If it's Chris Sununu on the Republican side and it is Colin Van Ostern on the Democratic side, Dan Barrick, we've talked about this before, in New Hampshire's supposed demographic problem, but here you have two guys who are, I think Chris Sununu's a little north of 40 and
yeah.
Colin Van Ostern's a little south of 40.
Right. And you saw that playing out a little bit in the gubernatorial race on the Democratic side where you had Mark Connelly, who I think is 60. He would talk about that a lot on the trail in the debates. I'm older. I'm more seasoned. I've had life experiences, subtle or not so subtle allusions to Van Ostern's relative youth. A lot of his supporters were of a different generation of Democrats. And you alluded to it earlier, this sort of the one knock you've heard. Republicans certainly bring this up a lot, and you even heard it when you talk quietly to Democrats who are not supporting Van Ostrand, this image of him as a kind of young man in a hurry. If Sununu is the nominee, I mean, he seemed – the only advantage he has is that his name is a lot older in New Hampshire politics than he is, you know, with his father and his brother's track record. But it will be a very interesting generational just a generational shift. The first time we've had, you know, two Gen Xers on the ballot for New Hampshire governor here.
Well, another young guy who made a good showing in the primary is Steve Marchand, former Portsmouth mayor, a businessman, worked at UNH. He came in second in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. And from this clip of tape, we're going to hear, guys, it sounds like Steve Marchand is not ready to exit the political stage. Let's hear.
So proud of the effort we put in on virtually no resources, getting in terribly late. This is not the optimal way to run for governor. But I think we had really bold ideas. And I think that even with very few resources, whether you're talking about marijuana legalization, abolition of the death penalty, paid family leave, and down the line, anti-Northern Pass 100%, these resonate with people, not just Democrats, undeclared voters, libertarian-leaning, moderate Republicans. I'm excited about the future because these are issues I can continue to advocate for on behalf of other candidates and to do whatever I can to help because these issues aren't going away.
And Kevin Landergan, probably Steve Marchand isn't going away. He was sort of the happy warrior in this race. Lots of energy and, you know, big smile on his face. And there he is. He did not come even close to Colin Van Ostrand last night, but content and excited about the future.
Yeah, certainly. And he provided the most contrast in this primary. There isn't any question about it. And was really aiming at the most liberal electorate in this race. And he's right about resources. He had very few. He was next to broke in those last couple of weeks of the election, had no paid media at all. I never saw a piece of mail. Maybe there was one that went out from Steve Marchand, but there certainly weren't any radio ads
actually,
or TV ads. But
yeah.
But he was badly outgunned in that regard. So in that respect, he did pretty well.
What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, Marchand's name has been one that's kind of floated around Democratic political circles for a while. This was his first real run at statewide office, and I think Kevin's right. He didn't have a lot of resources. He got off to a late start, but I think he impressed a lot of people in the debates. He did offer a very clear contrast. He was very energetic, and he seemed to really enjoy the campaign trail. I would not be surprised at all if we saw his name on the ballot again in a couple of years.
Yeah, even in that clip, you can tell he just, you know, too bad he didn't win, but he enjoyed the ride. So what about Mark Connolly, Kevin Landergan? He's someone who is not familiar to New Hampshire voters at large in general. I saw a fair number of Mark Connolly signs in my neighborhood, though.
Yeah, certainly. But a disappointing result for him. Not only finishing third, but he did a fairly good job at fundraising. He was competitive in that regard. Had some TV ads up that clearly just didn't resonate. Did not break through the clutter. And Dan may be right. I mean, some of it may have been a function of just people were looking for more vitality, a younger face. I think one of the problems Connolly had in this race, particularly against someone who has so much establishment backing, he never really focused on a signature issue that he owned as his own. And very often on a lot of issues, he was reluctant to take firm declarative positions like Marchand did.
All right. Well, coming up, guys, more on state primary results, including on Ask You Both about the second congressional district, the victory there, and also some down ballot races. Very interesting results for the Executive Council and the State Senate. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the results of yesterday's New Hampshire primary, some of the surprises, some close victories, and what to expect in November. The Exchange number for you to join us with your questions, comments, thoughts on last night's primaries and what it means for this fall's elections. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dan Barrick's here, NHPR Senior Policy and Politics Editor, along with Kevin Landergan, Senior Reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And gentlemen, we have not talked yet about the second congressional district. Ann McClain Custer, the incumbent Democratic congresswoman, had no challenger, so she's the nominee. But Dan Baer, just remind us who won on the Republican side.
So Jim Lawrence came out of a Republican primary where his main opponent was Jack Flanagan, both of them state reps, or I believe Lawrence is a former state rep. And he was – I mean, he won, I think, by about 10 or 12 points, so a fairly strong victory and largely expected. He had the advantage. He'd run 2 years ago and lost the Republican nomination for the same seat to Marilyn Garcia. He had a lot of backing of significant endorsers. He'll now go on to face Ann Custer, the incumbent. And I think to say bluntly, I think he's got a challenge ahead of him. This second congressional district in the state is clearly the more left leaning of the two, has been for a while. It's a presidential year, which we've said a couple times already today, tends to favor Democrats. Custer has the advantage of incumbency. She had no primary, so she's been sitting back for the last few months watching this, raising money, consolidating her support. And to win, for a Republican to win that district, you know, for the last 20 years, you have to really, you know, you have to be a kind of special kind of Republican. You got to be that, you know, kind of classic moderate,
a Charlie Bass,
or have some kind of, you know, crazy election like the 2010 Tea Party year. So I do think of the two congressional seats, this one will be getting less attention in terms of outside support and money, simply because it's seen as less competitive. Whether or not that's the case, we'll obviously find out, but that's the perception at this point.
Well, and Kevin, I want to hear from you too, but let's hear a little bit from Republican Jim Lawrence last night. This is after his defeat of State Representative Jack Flanagan, and Lawrence told his supporters, look, voters have spoken.
They want Washington, D.C. to stop overregulating and overtaxing our small businesses, allow our economy to grow, to keep us safe from terrorism around the world, and to allow the great people of the state of New Hampshire to attain what we all want, the American dream.
Again, that's Jim Lawrence last night. The Republican nominee this time around, as Dan said, Kevin Landrigan, he tried 2 years ago, didn't quite make it. So now he's the nominee. What else do we need to know about Jim Lawrence?
Well, certainly a big accomplishment for the state Republican Party. He's the first African-American to win nomination of a major party, either party in New Hampshire history. So that's a big accomplishment for certainly the national GOP coming after the 2012 election and loss to Obama. That was a big message they had. They felt, frankly, in 2014 that they had a good candidate, a minority candidate, Marilyn Garcia, a Hispanic woman, who they thought they could put up. And the national party got pretty invested in that race, and the results spoke for themselves. Custer won pretty convincingly, and I think that's the problem Lawrence has in this race, is getting national Republicans excited about the prospects of winning here. Maybe the fact he is breaking a milestone here will help him and get attention in Washington. That's really what he needs. And frankly, is one of his biggest hopes in getting any big national support from the congressional PACs and things that can dole out significant monies, is that Franken does look seen as a very vulnerable candidate in his own right. So Lawrence may well try and work that message down in D.C. that I'm a new face. I don't have damaged goods. Give me a shot.
You know, this is real interesting, Kevin. And if you and Dan could just explain to folks how strategic this is by the national parties, the congressional campaign committees, the Senate committees. You're so right, Kevin. These are the big national groups that say, okay, where can we win it? Where is it not worth it? I wonder if, you know, if you're a Republican at one of these committees in D.C. deciding where to dole out the cash, which district do you pick, Dan Baer? Do you pick CD1, where Frank Inta still does have this campaign finance scandal, won a squeaker yesterday, or do you pick CD2, where, as you said, it's a moderate to liberal district and you have a conservative Republican, not very well known, going up against an incumbent in relatively good standing?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, there's all those kinds of questions. And obviously, the folks making these decisions are sifting through all that data. And I think it's especially an interesting question in this year, in which we've seen evidence of major Republican donors hesitant to give money to the man at the top of the ticket, to Donald Trump, and trying to think strategically, how do you set up a bulwark in Congress to maintain the majorities there in the Senate and Congress, and who are the candidates you support? Kelly Ayotte is clearly benefiting from that. She's seen as a potentially vulnerable Republican incumbent whose victory is necessary if the GOP is going to hang on to the Senate. Does Frank Ginta now shift into that category on the congressional side? It's unclear. I mean, he showed a great deal of grit and tenacity to get through that primary. He's a known face before voters, but so is Carol Shea Porter. And it's also a presidential year. And she's going to be the beneficiary of that same kind of support on the Democratic side. So it's a great question, and it'll largely be playing out, unfortunately, on our TV screens over the next 2 months, I think.
I would love to be in that room where they decide, okay, yes, we're going to give some to Jim Lawrence. No, we're not going to give some to Frank Ginta, or vice versa. Just want to let everybody know that the Republican nomination for governor is still undecided. Right. We just got an update from Josh Rogers at the Unity Breakfast. He says Frank Edelblue just spoke at the Unity Breakfast, did not concede, but did go after Colin Van Ostern, the Democratic nominee, calling him a poser. So that race is still outstanding. Go ahead, Dan Barrick.
I'm just looking at the latest AP results that has 95% of the state in. There is just over 1,000 votes separating Sununu and Edelblue out of about 109,000 cast statewide. So this is
1,000 votes in a nomination for, the state's top office, really. Very interesting. Kevin?
Yeah, it truly is. The going back to what we were talking about, the national committees, one of the things they really play like almost a Russian roulette some months ago in this respect. In order to get the best TV advertising times, these national committees have to make reservations for that TV time like months out in front of the election. And in the case of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, they bought about $1 million of TV time in New Hampshire for late September and October. But they didn't identify where the money would go. And that's the decision they now make is whether—
Really? They buy the slots first?
Exactly.
With no names attached?
Because they have to. Because if you don't do that, obviously Trump and Clinton are going to take all the good spots.
So if you rates go up.
Exactly. The rates go up, and you also end up advertising at 2 in the morning instead of 8 or 9 o'clock at night when people are really watching TV. So these congressional campaign committees now are in the field. They're polling. They'll spend the next 10 days making that call. It's like Dan said, all the calculus they have to do is Ginta, can you rehabilitate him with the right TV spots, or should we take a flyer on Lawrence?
Well, that's a really interesting insight, Kevin, and I did not realize that. You buy the time first, you reserve it, and then you say, okay, I think we'll put Kevin Landergan in there instead of Dan Barrick or whatever. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments about some fascinating results from last night's primary voting and how the table is now set for November. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Well, guys, in the few minutes that we have left, I did want to talk about some down-ballot races, so to speak, and several state Senate races, Dan Barrick, that you were watching last night. What jumps out at you?
One race that got a lot of attention, District 24, which covers the Seacoast, it looks at this hour, that Dan Innes won a four-way Republican primary there. He's certainly well known to folks who kind of follow state politics. He'd been a congressional candidate, was considering running for Congress this year, and then changed his mind. So he'll be going up against Tom Sherman for that seat, one of the few quote unquote swing districts remaining in the Senate that could well determine which party controls that. Looks like Bill Gannon, a state rep, won the Republican primary in District 23, and he'll be facing Alexis Sherman, another potential swing district. Also, a lot of interesting primary results out of the Executive Council. We talked earlier about the fact that this is all of a sudden this year the launching pad for one, if not two, of the gubernatorial candidates. A number of interesting primaries there with familiar political names. Now going to be on the ballot, Andy Valinsky, a well-known Concord attorney who is in some ways the poster boy for the Claremont education funding lawsuits. He won the Democratic nomination for the District 2 seat. He looks to be a strong candidate there.
That's a very Democratic district. That was Colin Van Ostrand's district.
It's essentially gerrymandered.
Exactly. You look at the map and you go, wow, how did they tie all those towns together?
Right. I think it goes from the seacoast up towards the Upper Valley, which is sort of the Democratic heart of the state. Just another couple names. Russ Prescott, longtime state senator, Republican, won the Republican nomination for District 3. And Joe Kelly Lavasser, a well-known sort of figure in Manchester politics, will now be the he won the District 4 council nomination to take on Chris Pappas, the Democratic incumbent. So that there's going to be a fair amount and just District 5 with David Wheeler and Dan Weeks, the Republican and the Democrat, a fair number of interesting races for what's normally really down the ballot. But as we've seen the last few years, a very significant policy setting body.
Well, and let's talk about District 5 for just a second. Dan Weeks and David Wheeler, talk about political contrasts. Kevin Landrigan, voters there have a real distinct choice in that executive council race.
Yeah,
These two men are very different.
They are very different, and Weeks has put together a pretty good organization in a short amount of time, a good grassroots financial organization as well, I think done well. But
he's known as a sort of good government reformer, campaign finance, very progressive.
Very involved in that. But as Dan alluded to before, I mean, with a lot of these, most of these council seats are really heavily tilted to one party or the other. Wheeler was involved and on the council when they redistricted after the 2010 election. As a result, his district is more Republican than it was before, much harder for Weeks to break through. The same is true as we were talking about Andy Valinsky, almost impossible that he'll lose the November election. In District 3, Chris Sununu's seat, that he's leaving. Certainly Prescott's the heavy favorite. Beth Roth, a Salem lawyer, is a good candidate on the Democratic side. But once again, it's a very Republican-leaning district.
So these executive council districts, it sounds like, Dan, have especially been drawn to favor one party or the other.
They have. I mean, if you look at a map of the council seats, they look like almost sort of textbook gerrymander, that kind of crazy squiggle. And just given the fact that the council's less in the public eye, there's been less talk about that. But we've seen it, as we've mentioned on your show, the state Senate is also another place where it's had significant impact in the kinds of candidates who can run and who can win and really in the outcomes. So I do think there's really a small handful of state Senate seats that are going to be the places where that statewide battle is focused. And again, all the factors that we've been talking about tonight, you know, the Democratic a presidential year which favors Democrats, a volatile electorate and top of the ticket, potentially low turnout because of that. And the small number of battleground districts in the state Senate could really that could be one of, if not the most important outcomes of the November election, how those individual 24 races shake out.
Because as we talked last night, Dan, you know, in an era of congressional dysfunction, state legislatures and in New Hampshire's case, the state Senate especially is a place where people still work together and they still get stuff done.
Right. And we saw that time and again over the last few sessions, whether it was on Medicaid expansion or the state budget,
or the business taxes,
right? And also, you know, for the relationship between the state senate and the legislature largely, and the governor in New Hampshire, it's so key to we've seen split government off and on more often than not for the last few years here, and just that relationship between how that sorts out and the fact that we have two. We will have two, whether it's Sununu or Edelblue, two relatively at the top of the ticket for governor, unknown newcomers to statewide office, that there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of the state. We talk a lot about the presidential race and the U.S. Senate race and Congress, but we have no idea what the complexion of the state house in Congress is going to look like in January.
Kevin, you want to jump in?
That's true. The Democrats have some really good candidates for state Senate this time around. But the one thing they don't have that they've had before when they've taken over control of state Senate is a governor coasting. And that's what happened in 98, Jeanne Shaheen coasting the reelection. chose really got behind a lot of Democratic candidates. We had that in 2006 when John Lynch won 70% of the vote, coasted, chose a number of Democrats, campaigned with them in the last many weeks, even campaigned for some Republican moderates, by the way, in that election, which was really interesting. Colin Van Osten is not going to have that luxury. This is going to be a very competitive race for governor. And frankly, Chris Sununu and Colin Van Osten are going to have to pay attention to one another and not any other race on the ballot.
Well, and I want to let everybody know that there will be tons of opportunities to find out where these candidates stand. NHPR will be holding forums and debates. I'm sure, Kevin, you'll be involved in some of that as well. What do you think, guys, in this gubernatorial race will be? If you could just pick like two defining issues, Kevin, what do you think they would be? Will it be Northern Pass? Will it be business taxes? Will it be the state's demographic problems? Will it be higher ed? If you could just pick one or two.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think one – and that's certainly one of the challenges Van Osten has in this race, frankly, is particularly if Sununu is the choice, there's a lot less easy cookie cutter places for Van Osten to go because Sununu is pro-choice and he's okay on Medicaid expansion. We're not going to blow it up here. I think commuter rail is going to be a big defining issue in this race. And I think the state budget will as well, which is to say Sununu and Edelblue are going to carve out a very low-tax, anti-more spending while and try and put Van Osten in that taxer boss.
Sure, because right after the election, you turn around, it's a budget year.
That's right.
So the fun never stops. Could you pick one or two, Dan, that you think will define this gubernatorial race?
I really think the economy. I think the two very different contrasting visions that both parties have about the challenges facing the New Hampshire economy and the opportunities for how to redefine that. So for the Democrats, it's very much a broader question about not only taxes and costs of doing business, but broader family-friendly questions, linking higher ed to the workforce, whereas for the Republicans, they're focused on the sort of the classic Republican platform of cutting taxes, reducing the cost for companies to do business here. How those are defined, but I do think that's the field on which this race will be determined.
All right. Guys, thank you very much for coming in. I know it was a long late night for everybody. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.